Hello, in this podcast I want to discuss the chemistry of a croissant. When you sink your teeth into a croissant, I hope eventually that you'll think of some of the chemistry that I'm about to tell you. So I started my romance with a croissant when I was in France with my future wife, I suppose, going around backpacking, and each day we would treat ourselves to a croissant. A single croissant would break up between the two of us. We were pretty poor at the time, just walking around, but quite literally walking around France from city to city with our backpacks, and we enjoyed croissant. I think we had chocolate eclair with other things which we really enjoyed, and we tried to continue the tradition in Australia. It went for over a year until we hit a bakery in Dixon, ACT, and they produced such an oily, heavy croissant that cured us of it. And occasionally we still buy a croissant for enjoyment. So a croissant is one of those crescent-shaped, wrapped puff pastries that is so famous in France. This is Peter Hill Explains, and I discuss things scientific. In this particular one, I'm going to try and build in different threads. There's the thread of the actual yourself, where you've actually eating this stuff, there's the history thread, there's the mechanical thread of how you actually make a croissant, and the actual chemistry, the proteins and the amino acids. And there's one amino acid I want to get down to and discuss in detail. I should mention in Canada, when we were doing my postdoc in Canada, there was a restaurant called The Stuffed Croissant. Now, of course, the word stuffed in Australia is a swear word. We say, get stuffed if we don't like you. Oh, that's stuffed, it means it's broken. So The Stuffed Croissant is sort of fairly nice restaurant. It was a chain of restaurant. It was called The Stuffed Croissant. And to Australian ears, that sounds, this is the croissant which is actually broken and you throw out. It's stuffed. So that's a little bit of a story there. So the croissant, the history of it, is I've sort of been interested in the history of confections and stuff like that, because all too often you discover that the place it's associated with is actually not the origin of it. And this is true for croissant. Croissant, although very much loved by the French, is a Viennese pastry. Bought by people who set up Viennese pastry shops in Paris. It was very much liked, copied, and entered French cuisine. And I think the person, I really have to go, I've done no preparation for this, I think someone called Zhang, he may have been someone in the army or something like that. He was some sort of industrial, went back to be some sort of industrialist. But he gave France the croissant. And then there's the croissant general style of bakeries happens to be crescent-shaped. So people say, oh, look, it's to do with the celibate of the crescent of Islam. There's that story associated with it. Whether that's true or not, who really knows? It's the story. And croissant, it means a crescent. I think there's even croissants in Turkey, you've got this confection. It's a thing you have largely at breakfast, and let's talk about how it's made. You get a special flour and water, and you make that into a dough, and you knead the dough. And we'll discuss what that is actually doing a bit later on in the chemistry of it. But that dough starts off as a colloidal solution, that's flour just in the water, or is it running? And as you knead it, it becomes rubbery and gluey, like a glue. And we'll discuss the chemistry of what's happening there. And so it's a bit gluey, and so it you put it into a, you flatten it, and it's got a sort of plastic formation back into its original circular shape. It's got a bit of a stringy grain to it, so if you pull it, it pulls along grain. So something has happened from being a powder, flower of powder. The flower has cross-linked and formed a gluey component, and we'll talk about what's glue. And you get this, you put it on the table, you squash it out into a square shape, flat square shape. It's nice and flat and square. I wouldn't be able to do it myself. And it must, given that the fact that the flower's got a plastic or memory, it will pull back. So you've got to have it on the surface in such a way that it adheres to the surface and pulls it out. You then coat that with fat or butter. In the case of Dixon's, really bad quality. Bakery in Canberra, really almost synthetic motor oil, as I would have expected, but sort of high quality butters. Now, one of the interesting things about Australian butters is that we have a lot of salt in them. For some reason, Australian butters have salt, and overseas butters are salt free. But you spread this with butter, you got this square, and you get the corners of the square. And fold each corner into the center so that forms a sandwich, and the oil's on the inside, coat it on the inside, and you squish that down, and that's giving you a square half the size of the original square. And then you rotate that, so it's square again, and well, I suppose you don't have to rotate it if you're smart enough, but if you mathematically, you rotate it, so it's again 90 degrees, and you roll it out flat again, so it expands to back double its size to the original thing. Coat it with oil again and repeat this folding process. And this is a puff pastry where you get layers of pastry and oil, and of course the oil will create an area that the pastry will not stick to each other and separate, and so you get these thin layers of croissant. You taste it, and I don't know how many times you do it. I expect probably less than 100. Somewhere around the 20, 80 times you do it. You could actually yourself go through and count the number of layers in your croissant as you go through. So each layer's got this fat, so it's basically flour, water, and fat. And we'll discuss a bit. Or what the flour is, and you keep on doing this, and when you've done this sufficient times, instead of folding over a second time, you then cut from one corner to the other, and one corner to the other, and create four triangles. And with the four triangles, you move those, so you've got a triangle. I suppose it would have to be a right angle triangle, at 90 degrees. And you roll the fat, the flat edge, the long hypotenuse along, and you roll that until you get the edge of the triangle just coming over the very top, and then you form that into you wrap that. That's linearly, and you wrap it into a croissant, wrap it into your oven. And heat and go away. So that's the method of making a croissant. And so it's, I suppose, an interesting thing that when people see a croissant and eat a croissant, they don't necessarily think of the manufacture method of it. But once you've got the manufacture method stored away in your head, so let's just stop at the moment. We've got croissant, the history. It's come as a Viennese pastry, popularized in France and sort of adopted by the French, and perhaps improved by the French. Then you've got this method of production. Now, this would be quite labor intensive, so I assume that it's produced by robot or some sort of machine. I can imagine a machine now pumping these out, just spitting them out and putting them out. And obviously you've got the expense of a central machine, so you would freeze these. You know, snap freeze it. So you have to have a reasonable. Oh yeah, the entire thing of flours and stuff like that. You'd probably. So you also have a yeast in there, which is basically a fungus. The fungus then eats a component. The fungus doesn't eat the starch. Or depends what it eats. And there's also a raising agent. So you've got this this crescent, and when it heats up, the I think it would rise a little bit, and then you'd heat it up further, and it would rise even further. Further going as you heat it up. So there's a biological process of a yeast, some sort of yeast inside it. Obviously, there's not too much yeast because it's basically a pastry. You can still taste it as unleavened bread. The actual layers of pastry stay pretty much intact, but they separate and move apart. I don't quite know the physics and process of that moving apart. So we get back into the flour. Now this is something that I've been interested in. I've been interested in using flour to make ever stronger piñatas and how you do that. So a piñata basically is flour and water. You mix it together and then you have small chunks of newspaper and you get that and actually assemble your piñata on several layers, and the art of that is making your flour into a glue. So how does flour form into a glue? So obviously it's the glue process, and so let's look at what flour is. So flour is basically you've got two parts. So a seed of a plant comes in two parts. It comes with the embryo of the seed and a yolk sac. I don't know what the actual technical terms for these are. This is a food sac. And so you husk the seed to break off the actual DNA, embryonic sort of green tasting seed, and you save this yolk, basically egg yolk, storage for the plant. So this is the food source. So this little seed, when it grows, initially, when it firstly grows, its initial food source is this storage. Oh, I think endosperm comes to the way. Look, truly, it may be the correct word. It's just going around my brain, and the words are coming out for it. So it may be called endosperm, but it's this. So your seeds. Now it is interesting that seeded plants operate on. I think there's two lines of pollen goes up and fertilizes and starts the embryo up and starts to also build up the seed. There's a double process, fertilization process going on here. It's a pretty incredible process. So what happens is that the baby plant is grown with its food sac and then it stops. That's right. So it's fertilized, but and it's ready to go. So it's in a suspended state, and then it's got to be transported and go under the correct conditions to fertilize, to germinate, I think is the word. Again, this is just words off the top of my head, to germinate. And the important process here is that your food sac contains two items. It contains little spheres of sugar, insoluble sugar called starch, little balls of starch, and it also contains a protein soup. And we'll start to talk about what that is. And the important thing is that when water comes, this is water absorbent. It likes to pick up water, store water, obviously. When rain comes along, it's not got a root system. It needs to basically drink the water. So the protein drinks the water, absorbs the water, and then the embryo then initially, when it starts to grow, starts to eat the sugar, the starch, and use the protein to grow up. Obviously, it can't. It actually has to get that protein, which is a whole heap of amino acids, and process it on the inside. Now, given away that protein is proteins are chains of amino acids. So there's let's get it straight. Is 500 to 1,000 potential amino acids in nature, of which humans really use about 20. So you can get these in plants, you can get these weird amino acids which humans just don't recognize. And in insects and other things, other species use a different set. We use a basic set of amino acids, 20 amino acids, and our DNA encodons code for each amino acid. So our DNA is a long strip, and that corresponds to a long strip of amino acids, and the amino acids form a chain. Let's go what an amino acid is. It's, and I've done this before, it's an amine onto a carbon with that side chain. So amine goes to a carbon. The carbon has a side chain and then hooks up to a carbolic acid, a carbon with an oxygen and OH minus. So it's amine, which is base, and an acid at the other end with a side chain. And so essentially you have these building blocks, which goes nitrogen, carbon with a side chain, carbon with an oxygen, nitrogen. It links together. The acid and the base go together and release a water. This is an acid plus a base goes to a salt plus water. So amino acid is an acid and base, and it links together producing water casting off it. So it's like an acid-base reaction, but it's sort of like a Jekyll and Hyde in one molecule. So you've got that amino acid process going along here. And so there you have it. Your plants and your flower contains little starch balls, and milled around in little flowery circles is protein. So you've got a little starch ball, and which starch is, you know, molecule, and your protein is broken up and milled into a circle around like that. So it's transportable. Basically, you can pour flour in because it's a powder and it's easy to use. So it's basically a protein powder. And what's it? The general term for the protein of a seed, of the endosperm of a seed, which is put in flour, is called gluten. So you've got starch and the protein called gluten. And the word gluten means gluten. It's the Latin from a glue. And basically, it's a glue protein. And so gluten makes glue. It's sort of, and so flour makes glue. And what happens is that when you get flour, the starch is there for free, nothing much happens to it. I used to, my initial model is that it must be very flat surfaces in flour. Flour must be membranes which are rolled up and the water unrolls it. I couldn't work out how it forms a glue. But it's a bit more chemical in terms of that you've got these long chains, linear chains of amino acids. So every amino acid, a few amino acids long, form a peptide, hundreds of long form a protein, and the protein is a long strip. And when you release the strip and it folds up into a little ball. It could be formed into a sphere. It's called a globulin, if it's a glob, or another shape. And so this is, the plants have provided this, and when you need it, it forms a, it cross-links. So you've got two proteins, and you rub the two proteins together, and they react, and one protein now forms a longer strip. And the way that you need it can actually form these strips in a long length. And so if you need dough, you will actually have it. In certain circumstances, you can feel a chain length in it. And, of course, this chain length then is a plastic surface. So, essentially, eating bread or your croissant is actually eating glue, processed glue. And the idea is to hold this glue together. So you also want this to fluff up a little bit. So I think your... your yeast would be eating the starch. Your yeast eats the starch, produces a bit of carbon dioxide, changes the chemistry of it. And now the thing about flowers is that flower likes water. That's its aim of a seed, is to absorb a bit of water. But I suppose the amino acid in the gluten, which is really strong in the wheat, is something called proline. And so your amino acids break into two broad chunks. Your alkyl group, this is just carbon and hydrogen, and your aromatic groups with nothing on it, just carbon and hydrogens, but in a circle. So your alkyl and aromatic compounds with nothing, no hydrogens, no oxygens or sulfurs or nitrogens on it, just carbon and hydrogen. And those, if it's in its side chain, if it's just got carbon and hydrogen, so you've got 20 amino acids that we want to talk about, they're like an oil, they repel water. Now, the other amino acids, which have variously oxygens in it, nitrogens in it, sulfurs in it, these tend to suck in electrons and make it a polar amino acids, and these start to like water. So asparic acid is one which really likes water, so this builds up water. So in your protein, your gluten, there's a general class, and so people are gluten intolerant. Well, of all those glutens, there's actually some other. You go down, and there's only a few glutens which actually cause gluten intolerance, but it's pointless trying to explain that to people. But getting back up, I want to go up into, if you look at it, one of the major amino acids, which I want to talk about here, which you know is fascinating for me, is you would think alkyl groups, which is a side chain, so let's go through it. It's an amine, a carbon with a side chain, an amine hooked to a carbon, and that carbon has a side chain, and that carbon also has another carbon with an oxygen and OH, or carbolic acid to it, an acid to it. So if that side chain, the simplest side chain, I don't know, I've forgotten, the simplest side chain can be no side chain at all, just a hydrogen. Okay, that's water repelling. That's, you know, how simple can you get? And then you can actually build up just a few carbons. And what happens is there's a magic, I think it's maybe three carbons on that side chain of just carbon and hydrogen. And that's proline. And proline is a major constituent of flour and of your croissant. And what's so, what's interesting about proline? Proline is just long enough to actually pick its own nose, so to speak. It's long enough finger to go around, bend up, and react with the amine group. So it's got its own fake little circle in it. It really is the most amazing little standout amino acid. So it's an amino acid which has got this long, shorter than a finger, that it can go around and actually bend around and actually react and form a link, proline. So proline is sort of, if you're looking at your 20 amino acids, and I recommend just have a look at those 20 amino acids. And if you've got a good chart of the amino acids, they will have three-letter codons underneath it, which will give you the DNA sequence. So your DNA is basically a paper chart, like a menu order chart, this, then that. It's all linear and produces it. And so let's go again. When you're eating your croissant, you're actually eating a well-structured protein glue. And the protein glue is made out of amino acids. Proline's a key one. There's another water one. I don't know how much water is there. And depending on how you mill it, you get different properties of your flour. You can actually distress or insult your your starch, depending on what's going on your starch. And in these big industrial biscuit factories, at least in Australia, they have an electron microscope. And so the flour comes in, and then there's an electron microscope assay of the flour, and then that tweaks the humidity and the yeast. It's sort of, every biscuit is the same. There's a variation in flour with the weather and stuff like that and how it's milled, but the electron microscope and a fairly powerful computer sorts this all out. This is the Australian biscuit factories. So I would say that your chef, your person who's manipulating the dough, would say, oh, this needs a bit more water, this needs a bit more salt or whatever's in it. So I hope that's a good process for you. The aim of this particular podcast is to start linking more and more the history, the process, your physical sensation of eating a croissant, adding it together, and then linking it down to the chemistry, the protein, the amino acids. And look, there's only 20 amino acids. The amino acids only got one form of reaction, so it's fairly simple. It's got 20 methods, 20 variations it can do, and amino acids and proteins can only do certain things. Like if you beat an egg, you get the globulin proteins to stick together. If you knead flour, you get it to stick together and form a glue. I hope this is an improved podcast. That's the aim of my podcasting, to slowly improve my explanations as time goes by. And of course, not to do a simple podcast, but deal with those more complex ideas and add a bit of a scientific gist to, and hopefully teach other teachers who can actually grab students' attentions who may not be interested in chemistry, but they're definitely interested in, I was trying to think of the word, in eating and in food, the sensation. So you can actually taste your proteins. Okay, thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science.